Good afternoon, and welcome to Galecto's Expert Perspectives webinar on the evolving treatment landscape for IPF and the potential for GB0139. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A question and answer session will follow the formal presentations. If you would like to submit a question, you may do so by using the Q&A text box at the bottom of the webcast player or by emailing your questions to questions@lifesciadvisors.com. As a reminder, this webinar is being recorded and a replay will be made available on the Galecto website following the conclusion of the event. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Hans Schonbein, Chief Executive Officer of Galecto. Please go ahead, Hans.
Thank you, Tara. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Hans Schonbein. I'm the CEO and one of the founders of Galecto, and I'd like to warmly welcome you to this Expert Perspectives panel on the evolving treatment landscape for idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, or IPF, and the potential of our compound GB139 in this treatment. We will be making forward-looking statements today, and the actual results may vary from those. We have forward-looking statements available on our website. First, I'd like to give you just a brief introduction to Galecto. As you know, we are a clinical-stage biotech company. We're incorporated in the U.S., and we have programs at clinical stage focused on fibrosis and cancer. We develop small molecule inhibitors of two proteins, galectin-3 and LOXO2, which both have been shown to play key roles in the development and maintenance of fibrosis and cancer. Today, the focus is on IPF, and there is a very significant unmet need in IPF. There is about 100,000 patients in the U.S., 30,000 new patients every year, and 50% of patients in the Western world are not taking the two currently approved treatment, primarily due to very significant side effects. GB139, which is a dry powder inhalable galectin-3 inhibitor for once-daily dosing, has the potential to transform the treatment of IPF. It's differentiated in the way it works and the mode of action, and in current clinical trials, we deliver it directly to the site of the disease of pulmonary fibrosis, namely the fibrotic lung that is in the periphery of the lung. This is the focus, obviously, for discussion today. In addition to GB139, we have two other compounds in clinical testing, an orally active LOXO2 inhibitor that we developed for myelofibrosis and an orally active galectin-3 inhibitor that we plan to develop in both oncology and in liver cirrhosis. Now, I'm very delighted to welcome Professor Toby Maher as our key opinion leader for the webinar today. Toby is a professor of clinical medicine at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California, and he is widely respected as an expert in the field of interstitial lung disease and IPF in particular. He's also a British Lung Foundation chair in respiratory research and a professor of interstitial lung disease, and he heads up the fibrosis research group at the National Heart and Lung Institute at Imperial College London. Toby has a wide research range in the IPF spectrum within biomarker discovery, the lung microbiome, and host immune response in the pathogenesis of IPF. He has been involved in many clinical trials in the field of interstitial lung disease. More than 50 trials has Toby been working on, ranging from phase I-B trials to phase IVs, and he has given expert opinions to both the FDA and the EMA. Over the years, Toby has provided exceptional advice to Galecto and our IPF program. Toby will today discuss the current treatment landscape and the unmet medical need in treating patients with IPF. He'll look at the clinical meaning of the exciting biomarker data that we have generated for GB139, and this was recently published in the European Respiratory Journal, and that showed a marked impact on several biomarkers, some of which have prognostic significance. I'm looking very much forward to hearing Toby's perspective on this. After Toby's presentation, I'll give a brief update on GB139 and the current status after the recent recommendation from the Data Safety Monitoring Board to modify our trial. We will explain why we remain very confident in GB139 and the potential for the 3 milligram dose, which we will be testing in the ongoing trial. Toby and I, including Bertil Lindmark, Galecto's Chief Medical Officer, and Tarek Sethi, who is a co-founder of Galecto and Professor Emeritus of King's College London, will be available for questions after our presentation. It's now my pleasure to hand over to Toby for your presentation. Please go ahead, Toby.
Great. Thanks very much, Hans, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak at this meeting. You've kindly introduced me, so I don't need to go into great detail about my background, but suffice to say, I've spent much of the last 20 years working as an academic pulmonologist at the Royal Brompton Hospital and Imperial College in London, where we have a very large pulmonary fibrosis service, seeing in excess of 1,000 new pulmonary fibrosis patients each year. And that really provided the foundation for a lot of the clinical trial work that I've been involved in. And as Hans has said, I've been involved in almost all the IPF clinical trials running since 2008. More recently, I've transitioned to Los Angeles, where I'm now developing a research group and a clinical service at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. And clearly that gives me a perspective now on both sides of the Atlantic. Just to then introduce you to idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, IPF is a progressive scarring disorder of the lungs. As the name suggests, it's broadly of unknown etiology, although as I'll come on to, we've really began to understand the pathogenesis of the disease over the last 10 to 20 years. It is a disease of older adulthood. It characteristically affects older males in their mid to late 60s, and it presents with breathlessness that gets inexorably worse over time. And on average, without treatment, patients will die within about 3 years of initial diagnosis. So it's a pretty deadly disease. As you'll see from the next slide, what happens to the lung in IPF? So we have normal lung in the left-hand panel. We have fibrotic lung taken from a patient with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis in the right panel. What happens is that we not only see expansion of scar tissue, which is all of the pink stuff on the right-hand side, but we see loss of the normal alveolar architecture. So if you look at the left-hand panel, you'll see that the lung is made up of a lace-like network of alveolar spaces. These are obviously designed for the function of the lung, which is to facilitate gas exchange. And the oxygen and the carbon dioxide in the opposite direction travel from the alveolar space across the alveolar wall and into the alveolar capillary. As you can perhaps appreciate from the IPF section on the right-hand side, once the lung becomes destroyed by fibrosis, that function of gas exchange is lost. And really the images explain why it is that patients with IPF develop respiratory failure. The image also speaks to one of the challenges with treatment. Once this fibrosis is established and the lung architecture destroyed, it becomes a major challenge to halt or even reverse that sort of change. This graph just illustrates the life expectancy of patients with IPF. I've already told you the median survival is approximately 3 years from diagnosis. This graph was taken from a study that we ran prior to the advent of antifibrotic therapy. And really it just demonstrates that prior to 2012, when we saw the licensing of antifibrotic drugs in Europe, really there had been no advances in treatment or survival for patients with IPF, making it a truly dismal diagnosis for individuals. Importantly, and this graph illustrates two things, the incidence of IPF has been increasingly quite dramatically over the last 30 years. For reasons that we don't understand, the number of new cases of IPF each year has more than doubled since 1990. In actual fact, if we use the United Kingdom as an example, back in 1990, we were seeing about 2,000 new cases of IPF a year across the United Kingdom as a whole. By the end of 2010, that number had risen to over 6,000 new cases a year. As of 2020, I'm sure the number is even higher. And as I say, we don't understand exactly what it is that's driving that increase, whether it's perhaps environmental exposure to pollutants such as diesel fuel, or whether perhaps it's a case of seeing treatment improvements in diseases that would otherwise have killed patients before they got IPF. So improvements perhaps in the treatment of cardiovascular disease and cancer. A part of the increase is also explained by the general aging of the population. The panel on the right just illustrates the five-year untreated survival of IPF, which at about 20 to 25% makes the condition as deadly as many of our poorly treatable cancers, such as stomach cancer, non-small cell cancer of the lung, and esophageal cancer. So again, just emphasizing the deadliness of this disease. And just one more statistic to put in context how common IPF is. If you look at death certificates in the United Kingdom, or if you look at them in the year before COVID, certainly, IPF was responsible for about 1% of all deaths in the UK. So although we consider it a rare disorder, at the end of life, it becomes much more common and is perhaps much more common than people generally appreciate. If we then come to the clinical challenge of IPF, we recognize that the disease, once diagnosed, can behave in one of several ways. Perhaps 20% of our patients have very rapidly progressive disease, which is to say they go from first symptoms to death within about 12 to 18 months of diagnosis. At the other end of the spectrum, perhaps 1 in 10 of our patients have much more indolent disease. And these tend to be the long-term survivors who have a life expectancy sometimes of more than 10 years. The challenge being that we have no way of identifying these individuals at diagnosis. We can only recognize their longevity once it has been achieved. And then, of course, we have the average patient with a median survival of 3 years. And then the final challenge we see is something of acute exacerbation. And I will come to that in a couple of slides' time. So this was a study that we ran about 5 years ago at the Brompton, which just illustrates very nicely the different patterns of disease behavior that we see in IPF. This was a study where we gave patients spirometers, that is small devices to measure their lung function. And we asked them to measure their lung function on a daily basis at home. So each of these two graphs is one individual patient. If we look first of all at the left-hand plot, each dot here represents a single daily measurement of forced vital capacity, so really a measure of how big the individual's lung is. As fibrosis gets worse, the lung tends to shrink. And what you can appreciate with this individual is that there is day-by-day variability. The daily measurements do vary, but you can see that over the 18 months that he measured his lung function, there is an inexorable decline over time. On the right-hand panel, we have a patient with much more rapidly progressive disease. You can see the very steep downward trajectory of loss of lung function. And this patient died 220 days after enrollment in the study. And then the other pattern that we see is this pattern here, which, as I've told you, represents an acute exacerbation. So in acute exacerbations, we see that our patients with IPF are at risk of developing acute lung injury. An acute lung injury is the precursor to ARDS, or adult respiratory distress syndrome, which is what we see on the intensive care unit. It's what a lot of the severe COVID patients have ended up developing that's led to them being on the intensive care unit or dying. And for whatever reason, the IPF lung seems incredibly susceptible to developing acute lung injury. This can happen in response to viral infections. It can happen in response to patients undergoing surgical procedures. It can happen in response to treatments such as chemotherapy. And when it happens, the lung becomes rapidly damaged. You can perhaps appreciate in the CT image on the right-hand side here, all this dense white shadowing, which represents damage to the lungs. And once this process triggers off, the median survival is about 30 days. So half of patients will be dead within 30 days of the onset of an acute exacerbation. On the left-hand side, we have one patient who was doing the daily home lung function measurement. And you can perhaps appreciate that dip in the middle of the graph where he loses over a quarter of his lung function in a two-week period. This patient actually had reasonably well-preserved lung function to begin with, and he survived this episode of acute exacerbation. But nonetheless, these are episodes that our patients live in absolute fear of, and they affect about 1 in 20 patients with IPF each year. So just coming back to average disease behavior, this graph is just showing the disease behavior of all the patients that were in that study where we gave them the home spirometry. Each line represents an individual patient's disease trajectory. And as you can see, almost a quarter of patients have rapidly progressive disease, losing a quarter of lung function over the 52 weeks on this graph. About 1 in 10 have much more indolent disease, show stability over the year, and then the average patient loses about 10% of their lung function. So hopefully by now I've convinced you that this is a deadly disease for which we clearly need treatments. And we have over the last decade seen some important advances. Prior to 2012, the only real treatment that we had available for patients was lung transplantation. The picture on the left-hand side shows a patient who's had a left single lung transplant. So that nice big black lung is the transplanted lung. This CT is taken 5 years on from the transplant, and their right-hand lung, which is on the left side of the picture, has sort of really shrunken down due to the progression of fibrosis over time. The challenge is with transplant that we really don't have enough transplantable organs to go around. In a country the size of the United Kingdom, we do 300 lung transplants a year for all causes. And I've already told you, we diagnose over 6,000 new cases of IPF a year. And so you can see, even with optimal circumstances, a very small minority of patients with IPF are ever going to get a transplant. It was therefore important that in 2014, we saw the publication of pivotal studies, not just for one drug, but for two. And we saw the advent of nintedanib and pirfenidone as treatments for idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but to very quickly say, pirfenidone is a small molecule. We don't fully understand its mechanism of action. In preclinical studies, it seems to interfere with multiple inflammatory and profibrotic pathways, albeit with a low level of potency across any one pathway. When studied in the pivotal studies, we looked at change in forced vital capacity over 52 weeks. And compared with placebo, pirfenidone approximately halved the rate of decline over the 52-week period. As Hans has already alluded to, these benefits of treatment obviously come at the cost of side effects. Pirfenidone can cause quite challenging gastrointestinal symptoms, particularly nausea, loss of appetite, and weight loss. It can also cause photosensitive rash. And you can appreciate from this table the number of patients affected by these side effects. In clinical practice, what this means is that when we look at pharmaceutical or pharmacy returns in the US, we see that about a third of patients will have discontinued treatment with pirfenidone within 12 months of initiation due to side effects. Our other drug that we now have available is nintedanib. This is a multi-tyrosine kinase inhibitor that particularly interacts with VEGF, PDGF, and FGF. Originally, it was developed for oncology indications, but was shown in vitro to have antifibrotic effects. The parallel phase three studies were also published in 2014. And similar to pirfenidone, these showed approximately a 50% reduction in FVC decline compared to placebo over the 52 weeks of the study. And the major challenge with nintedanib in clinical practice is that it causes diarrhea and bowel disturbance in a significant proportion of patients. You can see this table here that shows that almost two-thirds of patients in the phase three trial reported diarrhea as a side effect. And again, in clinical practice, this has an important knock-on effect in terms of patient adherence to therapy. And again, looking at pharmacy returns, we see about 35% of patients discontinue treatment within 1 year because of side effects. That challenge notwithstanding, we have seen from a number of registry data sets, so real-world data, that the advent of antifibrotic therapy has been associated with an improved survival for patients with IPF. The graph on the left-hand side on the top comes from an Australian registry. The graph on the bottom comes from a European registry. And both of these registries have reported a similar finding that treatment with antifibrotic drugs has been associated with improvements in median survival for patients with IPF. And that holds true when you correct groups for time from diagnosis and disease severity. The graph on the right represents a study that we undertook using open label treatment data from patients who were in those original pirfenidone pivotal trials. We compared patients who'd taken pirfenidone for upwards of 10 years with age and severity matched patients from a disease registry in the United States. And just to sort of orient you on the graph on the right-hand side, the line that abounds the gray area, so the first line towards the left-hand side, represents the median survival of patients who were age and severity matched for the clinical trial participants. And because clinical trial participants tend to have milder disease, the average survival was about 5 to 5.5 years. The dark blue area represents the difference seen in survival following long-term treatment with pirfenidone. So the caveat is these patients were tolerant of long-term treatment, but what appeared to be true is that the drug provided probably an extra 2 to 2.5 years of life expectancy for patients. The third line that abounds the pale blue area is actually the median life expectancy for a 67-year-old drawn at random from the general public. And this would tell us that your average untreated IPF patient has lost approximately 15 years of life expectancy. And so although we're getting 2 extra years of life expectancy with antifibrotic drug, these patients are still missing out on 13 years of otherwise expected life expectancy. So we've still got a long way to go before we restore normal survival expectations to our patients with IPF. Just pivoting slightly, it's worth being aware that IPF is not the only fibrotic lung disease that we deal with in clinical practice. In actual fact, for every patient that I see in my clinic with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, I will see 2 other patients with other forms of fibrotic lung disease. And these can be fibrotic lung disease in the context of autoimmune diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis or systemic sclerosis. They can be fibrotic lung diseases due to inhalational injury, such as hypersensitivity pneumonitis or diseases like asbestosis. Or they can be some of the rarer diseases that we see in practice, such as sarcoidosis or drug-induced lung injury. And importantly, with the established antifibrotics, we've seen that they not only work in idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, but that they work in many of these other conditions. So this is data looking at nintedanib as a treatment for systemic sclerosis-associated interstitial lung disease. And we see a similar 50% reduction in decline compared with placebo. And then this was a very broad study of patients with any form of fibrotic lung disease, which had been getting worse over the preceding 2 years. And again, we see this similar effect of nintedanib, that it slows rate of FVC decline by about 50%. We've seen some similar studies, although not quite as robust, with pirfenidone. And overall, the take-home message would seem to be that an antifibrotic drug doesn't just work in idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, but it should also work in other forms of fibrosing lung disease. And then, of course, it's worth saying that the lung is not the only organ that suffers fibrosis. We see skin fibrosis, both in the context of diseases like scleroderma, but also keloid scarring. We see cardiac fibrosis, particularly as a cause of dilated and arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy. We see liver fibrosis in the context of cirrhosis, renal fibrosis in end-stage renal disease, and bone marrow fibrosis causing myelofibrosis and the problems associated with that. And one might imagine, particularly looking at the preclinical data, that a drug that works in one organ with fibrosis is likely to be effective across a range of diseases. And then, just using available evidence, we have seen that probably combination therapy is going to be more effective than therapy with a single agent. There have been some short trials combining pirfenidone and nintedanib. These have shown greater efficacy of the combination compared to one single treatment alone. But the problem we have with the existing treatments is their very poor tolerability. Half of patients who were tolerating a single antifibrotic therapy who entered one of these studies and took combination therapy was, by the end of 3 months, unable to tolerate at least one of those treatments. And in about a quarter of cases, had stopped antifibrotic therapy altogether because of side effects. So these trials speak to the importance of combination treatment for the future, but they tell us that our current drugs are not very good for combining. As I've already told you, over the last decade, we've really increased our understanding of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. We recognize the contribution of genetics. We see changes in a number of genes affecting either wound healing pathways, cellular senescence pathways, or pathways involved with cell turnover, all increasing the risk of development of IPF. We also increasingly appreciate the role of the environment. So inhalational injury over a lifetime contributes to the risk of developing IPF. And then, as I've told you, this is a disease of older adulthood. And so there is the important role of aging in the development of the disease. And when we see this triad of factors, genetic susceptibility, environmental exposure, and aging, we then see a population of patients at increased risk of developing disease. Once IPF does develop, we recognize that pathways involved in the normal wound healing response become activated, and they become activated in such a way that we see an imbalance favoring profibrotic mediators that leads to activation of multiple cell types in the lung, fibroblasts, epithelial cells, macrophages, which leads to collagen and extracellular matrix deposition, which leads to the destruction of the lung that I've shown you. And this in turn drives a feed forward loop where the stiffer lung with the altered extracellular matrix in itself becomes profibrotic. And that tends to drive fibrosis forward, even in those diseases where we can potentially treat the upstream cause for the fibrosis. And importantly, we've seen the advent of clinical trials over the last 10 to 20 years in IPF. And there are a large number of potential molecules in development. It is a very active research space at the moment. I've tried to break some of these potential treatments down by the mechanism and the mechanism which they target in the injured lung. As you can see, galectin 3 is up here, potentially targeting the macrophage and the injured epithelium. A lot of the interest in developing therapies has been about targeting the fibroblast directly, and that's probably how nintedanib and pirfenidone work. It's also something we see with CTGF inhibition, as being developed by FibroGen. It's something we saw with autotaxin inhibitors, and was certainly the rationale underpinning Galapagos's autotaxin trials. But focusing now on Galectin-3 and the trial that we ran as the precursor to the Galactic trials, I think you're going to hear a bit more about the mechanisms by which Galectin-3 is involved in fibrosis, so I'm not going to focus on that. But I will focus on the 2A study that we ran a few years ago now, and the rationale that that provided for moving forward with clinical trials in IPF. Essentially, we designed an adaptive study that was going to give us high quality evidence about target engagement. And at the same time, we built into it biomarker assessment that would give us some indication of the potential antifibrotic effects of targeting Galectin-3. As the schematic on this slide shows, we developed the study using multiple ascending doses. We had six patients in each cohort randomized to either placebo or active treatment. Patients underwent bronchoscopy both at the beginning of treatment and at the end of treatment, and that allowed us to measure target engagement within the lung. This slide here just demonstrates, firstly, on the left-hand side, that targeting or delivering treatment via the inhaled route actually gave very consistent PK data measured in the plasma of these patients. But importantly, when we looked at engagement of alveolar macrophages, we could see a dose-dependent increase in intraalveolar concentration of the drug. But importantly, we also saw a dose-dependent reduction in extracellular Galectin-3 levels on the alveolar macrophages, which is to say the drug was doing exactly what it was anticipated to do when it was developed. This slide just expands on that final graph that was on the right-hand side of the last graph. This just shows you the individual data points that fed into that. And you can see here, particularly focusing on the 3 milligram dose, that there was a very clear difference using the individual patients as their own control between pre-treatment GAL3 expression on the alveolar macrophages and the post-treatment expression following 14 days of treatment. And you can see that there's a very clear p-value there. And the effect is not dissimilar to the effect that was seen in the 10 milligram dose. And again, you can see that the drug concentrations feed in to a nice relationship with the Galectin-3 expression. Again, providing a nice PK-PD relationship between exposure and effect of the drug in patients with IPF. As I told you, the study also incorporated measurement of a range of biomarkers. The biomarker development area in IPF is quite active. It's worth saying that your whole body circulation of blood passes through the lungs every minute. And so the lungs are actually a very rich source of biomarkers. And when we've done observational studies in IPF patients and look at a wide panel of potential protein biomarkers, we find very big differences between IPF patients and healthy volunteers. And increasingly, we're recognizing a panel of biomarkers that distinguish progression of fibrosis over time in this patient group. So important prognostic biomarkers. Within this study, we looked at a panel of biomarkers, and I've got some of the data here. PDGF is produced by a number of cell types. PI1, YKL40 tend to be macrophage produced and are produced by profibrotic macrophages. And you can see we have the placebo, the pooled placebo patients, and then we have the biomarkers as measured in the active treatment patients. And we should focus on the 3 milligram dosing group of GBO139. And you can see here that at this dose, we see a clear downregulation of all of these biomarkers. And this downregulation correlates with the changes in surface galectin-3 expression. And then this is the same data, just looking at two further biomarkers, a different isoform of PDGF, and then MCP1, another macrophage, profibrotic macrophage released biomarker, which associates very well with disease progression in IPF. And again, you can see a similar story, that the 3 milligram dose results in a nice downregulation of the biomarker. And then finally, touching on safety, in that phase 2A study, we really didn't see any safety signal whatsoever, albeit that we were dosing over a very small treatment window and with very small numbers of patients. This here is the blinded treatment data from the GALACTIC-1 study, so the currently running phase 2B trial in IPF patients. And the safety table is broken out based on those patients who are on background treatment with either nintedanib or pirfenidone, and background treatment, and those patients who weren't on background treatment with either of the existing antifibrotic drugs. You can see approximately twice as many patients had background treatment as compared to those who didn't. And just as a reminder, given that this is blinded data, these patients could have been on the 10 milligram dose, the 3 milligram dose, or placebo. And they were, the randomization schedule was 1:1:1. What we can see here is that there are slightly more serious adverse events occurring in the patients on background treatment, 19.7% compared to 10.6%. However, we are still looking at relatively small numbers of affected patients. And then if you look at respiratory severe adverse events, you can see that there's a slight excess in those patients on background treatment compared to those who were on no background therapy. And the same is true for infections and infestations. I would remind you that in the pivotal trials of nintedanib and pirfenidone, the numbers of severe adverse events that we were seeing was approximately 30% over the 52 weeks, just to put that in context. But perhaps we'll have the opportunity to discuss this in more detail in the question and answer session. So just to summarize my talk, IPF is a very nasty disease and one that certainly none of us ever want to be diagnosed with. We've seen that the existing antifibrotic drugs do seem to be genuinely effective. They slow disease progression and in turn, they extend life, but they are poorly tolerated. And as I've told you, there is still a huge life expectancy deficit for a patient diagnosed with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, even if they go on to early therapy. I've told you that we can now use biomarkers to help us deliver more effective proof of concept trials to give us some indication of genuine antifibrotic effect in short term studies. And I've shown you that GB1039 targeting galectin-3 dosed for short periods of time appreciably impacts biomarkers of pulmonary fibrosis. So I will now hand over for the next speaker.
Thanks a lot, Toby, for this very excellent presentation of where we are with IPF treatment today and the very significant unmet medical need and also the promise that previous trial held for GB139. So now I'm just going to spend a few minutes talking about GB139, the recent recommendation from the DSMB and what we're doing from here on. And then we want to leave ample space for questions from the audience. So just to remind everybody on this slide here, when we look at GB139, there are several aspects of it that are really attractive compared to both existing therapy, but also to other late stage drugs in development. First of all, that we are delivering the compound as an inhaled, so delivering directly to the site of the disease. But pulmonologists really like providing inhaled therapies, use that all the time for their COPD and asthma patients. So this is clearly attractive. As Toby just showed you, we have shown that we can deliver the compound very efficiently at a high concentrations to the lung, to the site of the disease, and we target there the macrophages. We have a pluripotent mode of action that I'll just come back to, where inhibiting galectin-3 doesn't impact all of the cells that are important for driving the fibrotic pathway. And then finally, as Toby also showed, we have demonstrated the mode of action of the compound on the right cell from the right compartment in patients with IPF in the removal of galectin-3 from the cell surface. And that linked very well up to the dose response effects on several biomarkers. So focusing in on galectin-3 and its role in, I am having problems advancing. Could you go to the next slide, please? I don't know why this is, thanks. So galectin-3 has been shown to play a role on the activated macrophage, on activation of epithelial cells and transformation into fibroblast, and also activation of fibroblast. So all of the cell types that are involved in the fibrotic cascade. We and others have shown both in vitro, in vivo, and indeed, as you've seen in patients, then inhibiting galectin-3 can impact the activation of macrophages and also reduce the activation of epithelial cells and the production of collagen by fibroblasts. So by inhibiting galectin-3, you simply target more of the aspects of the fibrotic cascade than you do with other ways of engaging IPF. Next slide, please. So recently we announced that, much to our surprise, the Drug Safety Monitoring Board for the ongoing phase 2B trial had identified an imbalance in the severe adverse events in the trial, so they saw more in the patients that were receiving GB139 on top of pirfenidone and nintedanib, or in the patients who are receiving 10 milligram in patients who are not currently on pirfenidone and nintedanib. Importantly, there was no difference in mortality. So this numerical difference did not translate into mortality increases. Because of these observations, the DSMB recommended that we cease dosing patients who are on background therapy, and also that that we cease the 10 milligram standalone dosing. We were, however, allowed to continue with the 3 milligram dose, and that's indeed what we plan to do. So this, of course, is very important. And in contrast to other recent trials from Galapagos and Biogen, where the trials have been stopped altogether. So encouragingly, we were allowed to continue and will be able to test now the effect of the 3 milligram dose on these patients. Next slide, please. So we have now redesigned the trial, and there will be just two arms in GALACTIC-1 going forward, but this will be placebo compared to 3 milligrams. We will randomize the patients in a 2-to-1 ratio, so we will have twice as many patients on active versus placebo, which means that we continue with an unchanged likelihood of being randomized to active treatment. And the power of the study also remains the same. Interestingly, when we initially started work on this trial, we wanted to work to study patients who were not on pirfenidone or nintedanib, because it would be a cleaner trial without the confounding factor of patients being, some patients being on treatment, others not. However, the FDA wanted us to also include patients on pirfenidone and nintedanib, Now, because of the findings of the DSMB, we're back to where we wanted to be in being able to study patients who are not on background therapy. You may think that this will then dramatically impact the market potential for GB139, but there are a couple of things that I'd like to remind you in this context. If we're able to, as we hope, demonstrate that the compound is safe and well tolerated and has good efficacy, this will be a very attractive compound to administer to patients by the pulmonologist. This will be both patients who have tried pirfenidone and nintedanib and have stopped treatment, as Toby alluded to, but also to newly diagnosed patients. And because of the rapid turnaround and the high mortality, about one third of all patients every year are new patients, so new prescriptions. So there is a very large and addressable market for GB139 should we be successful in this trial. Now we'll move over to the Q&A session, and Toby is available to respond to you, as well as the Chief Medical Officer, Bessel Lindmark, and my co-founder, Tariq Sethi, who is also available on the call. So with that, I'll hand back to you, Tara.
Thank you, Hans. At this time, we'll be conducting a question and answer session. If you would like to submit a question, you may do so by using the Q&A text box at the bottom of the webcast player or by emailing your questions to questions@lifesciadvisors.com. Please hold while we pull for questions.
Great. If I could start off, we've got a handful of questions that have already come through, and we can obviously continue to address these. But let's start with first from Tom Smith at SVB Leerink for Toby. Of the biomarkers highlighted, which, in your opinion, is the strongest evidence linked with disease prognosis or outcomes? And related to that, which of the biomarkers gives you the most confidence that the drug is actively impacting fibrosis or fibrogenesis?
And I think probably it's actually the combination more than any one alone. I think of all the ones that I showed, MCP is probably the one with the best linkage to disease progression. But I think the strength of the panel that was used is that we know that the cellular sources of those biomarkers are different. So it's not just that we're measuring the impact of galectin-3 inhibition on profibrotic macrophages. We're also seeing with some of the markers, such as PDGF, that there also seems to be a knock-on effect on other cells that play an important part in fibrosis, particularly the epithelium and also the fibroblasts. So I think to a certain extent, it's seeing the effect across the broad panel, which reassures us that although the galectin-3 may be primarily impacting macrophages, it's having knock-on effects down the sort of cascade of cells involved in fibrosis and the development of the fibrotic tissue.
Great. Another question in from Geoff Meacham of Bank of America. For Toby, I understand the need to develop GB139 as a monotherapy initially, but down the road, do you imagine combo therapy still being an option? Is it worth doing that as well up front?
I think our vision of success for the future ultimately is combination therapy. And whilst I would like to imagine that any one drug might be the miracle drug that transforms outcomes for IPF, I think the complexity of the disease and the pathogenesis speaks to the fact that in the future we will need combination treatments. And I think, you know, we haven't seen the full data set that the DSMB used to come to their conclusions. But, you know, from my perspective, it's what we're looking at with the blinded data is not out of the ballpark of what we expect in IPF studies in general. We expect quite a lot of events in an IPF population. And so I think there will certainly be a case for revisiting the role of TD1039 as a combination treatment in the future.
Another question from Tom Smith at SVB Leerink. Toby, does the recommendation to move forward with dosing arms that do not include background standard of care change how you think as a clinician when enrolling patients into the study? And there's a couple of related questions on that. Based on previously generated phase 2A data, do you have any reservations about moving forward with the 3 milligram dose versus the 10 milligram dose? And then how do you think of these recommended changes in terms of impact regarding pace of enrollment with your patients?
So I think certainly, as Hans said, just from a sort of clinical trialist perspective, doing the trial on no background treatment obviously gives you the biggest window over which to see a treatment effect. I think, you know, part of the reason we didn't go for an upfront sort of placebo only trial was for some of the reasons alluded to in the question asking, which is to say that your average informed patient would probably choose to start an antifibrotic at point of diagnosis. But it's worth remembering that in quite a few territories around the world, the United Kingdom being one of them, about half of patients are excluded from treatment because of reimbursement issues. So in the UK, for instance, there are upper and lower limits of forced vital capacity for whom we can prescribe any antifibrotic drug. And so we have a captive audience of patients who are on no treatment, who are very keen for clinical trial options. And we know from other studies that those patients behave in terms of disease progression in an identical way to patients who are able to access treatment. So I think there is a large pool of patients globally who can't actually access treatment, who are keen to be in trials. It undoubtedly will have some impact on recruitment, but I think by focusing on those countries where treatment is not available universally, some of those issues can be overcome. And as Hans has said, the one benefit from this is that you do have a wider window in which to show benefit of treatment. You'll expect the placebo group to get worse more quickly in the patients on no background treatment. And so ultimately, from a power perspective, even though the study will be smaller, it should still give us the same level of information. Clearly, it's a bit of a shame to lose the 10 milligram dose, but I think if you look at the phase 2A trial, we still see a very clear effect of the 3 milligram dose on all of the biomarkers that we looked at. And so one would still anticipate efficacy with that dose. It's obviously a bit of a loss, but I don't think it's insurmountable. And I would hope that we will still see a benefit of treatment in the study as it's now continuing.
Great. Thanks, Toby. A few more questions for you that are coming through. Next one from Alex Stranahan from Bank of America. How have you controlled the heterogeneous rate of progression of patients with IPF in your clinical studies that you've worked on, and any other caveats to note when designing trials for this patient population?
So in general, at the population level, we find that if we use sort of strict inclusion criteria around CT appearances, we can end up with a fairly homogeneous population in whom we can overall predict disease behavior. So over the last decade, most late phase IPF trials have used central reading of CT scans and have gone after specific CT patterns to define the diagnosis of IPF. And in doing that, we know that an untreated population of IPF will on average lose about 220 mils of forced vital capacity. And that's been very consistent. So I think in a trial of this size, although there will be individual by individual heterogeneity in disease behavior, overall at the population level, I think they should behave in a way that's consistent with other studies.
Great. And another one from Tom Smith at Leerink. Toby, how do you think about enrolling patients into the Galactic 1 trial versus other clinical studies ongoing within IPF that you're working on?
I think if you look now at the remaining treatment landscape, The other two late phase trials that are still running are both of intravenous drugs. So Fibrogen's CTGF inhibitor and what was Promedial's drug, but is now Genentech's drug, which is also an intravenous preparation. And so I think, you know, this drug, TD-1039, has the huge advantage of being very simple to administer. It's an inhaled drug, and therefore participation for patients in the study is very straightforward, as compared with these other trials that mandate very frequent hospital visits for intravenous administration of therapy. And it's worth saying that since the COVID pandemic, patients have been terrified of coming up to hospitals because they perhaps rightly fear that the hospital is the place where they're most likely to catch COVID. So being able to deliver an agile study where the treatment is administered by the patient at home is a huge advantage. So from my perspective, it's much easier to recruit for this study than it is with one where we need to administer intravenous therapy.
Great. And Toby, another one for you. This one from Sebastian Vandeschoot from Kempen. Given the differences in administration between GB139 and currently approved IPF drugs, could you indicate whether the type of SAEs seen with the interim review of GALACTIC-1 during the announced data were similar in nature as seen with other IPF drugs, or different and perhaps related to the inhalation aspect of delivery?
So if we sort of think back to that table that I showed, in fact, I can probably show it again, actually. Is that going to come up? There we go. I think overall, we're looking at very similar rates of AEs and very similar pattern of AEs than we've seen in other studies. And it's worth, whilst I don't have the data, I'm almost certain that the patients who weren't on background therapy will have had milder disease for the reasons I've already alluded to, that in territories like the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and several other countries, the patients who are excluded by reimbursement from treatment are the patients with milder disease. And so in milder patients, we see a far lower frequency of both respiratory tract infections, but also other things like acute exacerbations. And so we do tend to see this differential based on disease severity in a number of these AEs. And I'm strongly suspicious that that explains the imbalance between the patients who are on background therapy compared to those who aren't. But overall, just looking at this table without the sort of blinded treatment information, there's nothing that jumps out that is out of the ordinary for an IPF clinical trial.
Great. Next question, Toby, for you again from Julian Harrison at BTIG is, how important do you think showing additive activity on top of pirfenidone or nintedanib is to the current or future treatment options?
So I think, to my mind, there's two ways of viewing treatment developments, or three ways maybe of viewing treatment developments in IPF. One can have a drug that has a similar efficacy to existing treatments, but is much better tolerated and is arguably easier to dose. So one could imagine a scenario where TD-139 is of equal efficacy, but is much better tolerated, in which case that there is going to be a preference on part of patients and physicians to get patients preferentially onto monotherapy with the drug. The other situation where I think drugs are approvable and would be used is if they had better efficacy, but, you know, equivalent tolerability to the current drugs. And one wouldn't imagine that an inhaled drug is going to fall into that situation, in the sense that one wouldn't expect tolerability to be as challenging as it is with the current drugs. Clearly, if TD-139 has better efficacy and better tolerability, then that's sort of a home run. But as I've alluded to, my expectation ultimately is probably the best way to get incremental benefit is to have multiple drugs on top of each other, in which case an inhaled drug does make an attractive partner for the existing drugs, because again, one wouldn't anticipate the overlapping GI side effects, which make combination therapy with either pirfenidone or nintedanib very challenging for any other drug that has a similar tolerability profile. So I think either scenario would work. Equal or better efficacy with better tolerability could make TD-139 sort of ideally first-line treatment, ignoring the reimbursement issues for a moment, but potentially first-line treatment ahead of pirfenidone nintedanib, or being able to use it on top of pirfenidone nintedanib as an inhaled drug would also be a scenario where it would be widely used.
Great. This next question is for both Toby and the company. Alec Stranahan again from Bank of America. Thoughts on autotaxin as a target given the recent phase 3 trial discontinuation by Galapagos and read through to other fibrosis targets such as galectin 3?
I can go first. So I have a conflict of interest with Galapagos as well, in so much as I was the chief investigator of their trial also. It was a bit of a surprise that the drug was also halted by the Data Safety Monitoring Committee, particularly as that we were 2 years into trials with over 1,000 people in both studies. So it was a very late and presumably fairly subtle signal that the DSMB used to terminate the study. I guess part of the key will be understanding what it was that led to the study termination and how important was the safety signal. Was it an off-target effect? Was it compound specific or was it pathway specific? And I guess with the study being the size it was, one would expect to be able to make some assessment of efficacy. So I think one would be looking to see whether there was at least a trend towards improved outcomes in patients on the Galapagos autotaxin inhibitor. So I guess we will still learn a lot from that study, and it'll tell us a reasonable amount about the viability of the autotaxin pathway. Without knowing the answers to all of those questions, certainly the preclinical data supporting targeting the autotaxin pathways was strong. And so I wouldn't rule out autotaxin as a pathway at this point in time, but I guess we'll have to reserve a bit of judgment until we've seen the fuller data set from Galapagos.
Yes, I agree.
Oh,
Tarek, do you
want to
go?
Yeah, you can go as well, Hans. I was going to say I agree with Toby. I think I was surprised. You know, Galapagos data did have a very good phase 2 results and lung function data in that they went forward with. It had gone on a long trial, and I think probably the only additional comment I would make, and I'd be curious for Toby's thoughts on this, is of course, you know, Galapagos had been running for a long time and recruited a lot, but then suddenly hit you know, COVID, and you know, the challenges probably around COVID when, you know, trial wasn't anticipating that. And I do at least wonder, or I'm curious, I think, to see what impact that might have had on the study and so on. So I think there's still a lot of data for us to look at, and the reasons why this has happened. And it, yeah, it came as a genuine surprise to us. And, you know, I'm still curious, I think, to see the data.
I know, I would agree about the effects of COVID. And I think COVID was a real wild card for anyone running late phase clinical trials in the last year. And, you know, there will have been COVID related deaths, which obviously, you know, may have created imbalances and becomes very difficult to interpret. So I think there will be a lot to tease out from the sort of Galapagos outcomes that will help inform other clinical trials going forward, not just the autotaxin inhibitors.
Great. We're getting some similar questions from folks. I'll combine them and try to pose them appropriately here. Next up would be, is the biodistribution of GB-0139 in fibrotic tissues well understood? And which concentration of GB139 do you believe is most linked to efficacy, lung tissue concentration or airway concentration? So I don't know if maybe Hans, Tarek, or Bertel, maybe one of you could join in on those.
So I'll take it first, and then Hans, you can sort of help me out. But really, the PK/PD data that we saw, so that is, you know, the amount of drug we could get in, and then the effects those drugs had, and the distribution, I think, both in the lung and also into the circulation, was very good, I think, both with the 3 milligrams and above. We're always in that really well above the concentration that we want to see target engagement and inhibition of galectin 3. I think, and again, I think Toby will also have thoughts on this, but our feeling really was that the concentration in the lung is of paramount importance. In a sense, you know, the fibroblastic foci which drive fibrosis are the sort of leading edge of fibrosis. And so I think inhibiting the activation of fibroblasts and the laying down of collagen, you know, it is important. So I think that it's very much a lung concentration. Obviously, there are recruited macrophages that come in. And in fact, even in the circulation, we are getting quite good concentrations of drug there. But it's really, I think, the lung concentrations that we're particularly interested in. The airway concentrations, of course, have an effect on the epithelium, which, as Toby said, is also important. But I'd say the interstitium of the lung is the key, and we're really seeing very good concentrations of drug in the lung.
Yes, the way we designed the trial, we were able to get data both from the concentration of the drug in the lung lining fluid, so the fluid that's on the epithelial layer in the alveoli, in the macrophages, and then obviously, as you saw, in plasma. And the plasma concentrations are about 2% of the concentrations that were in the lung lining fluid. So we do think that the lung lining fluid is the most important in terms of impacting the fibrotic activation, and that of course also is closely related to the concentration of the drug that's in the interstitium. So given the effect, the correlation from the effect on biomarkers and galectin 3 on the cell surface of macrophages, I think we have good evidence that it is the lung concentration that we measured that's the most important indicator of activity.
Great. Next group of questions, again, that I'll combine and pose as one. Maybe Bertel, you could best address these. Number one, how frequently does the DSMB meet, and has the frequency or timing of these meetings changed following the latest recommendations? And related to those, can you share some insight as to alignment with the regulatory bodies regarding timing of the proposed protocol amendments and the impact to the trial recruitment?
Yeah, I think the we saw an extra meeting just before we got the recommendations from the Drug Safety Monitoring Board. But other than that, we have not seen any change, and we do not anticipate any change in the frequency of the Data Safety Monitoring Board. We have, with regard to the regulatory acceptance, this is, of course, a bit of a future question for us, because we are now in the process of submitting the change protocol, and we believe that we will get responses back and be able to restart the study within the next 6 to 12 weeks. I think those were the two questions I understood.
Yeah, I think that's right, Bertel. And I guess related to that, there are several questions asking about the impact on patient recruitment and changes to target population sizes for the 3 milligram and placebo arms?
So we have centers in large parts of the world, Australia, US, Europe, Canada, Israel, and Eastern Bloc. And we're also in the process of increasing the numbers of centers because we, as we've seen before, there may be some resistance to including patients that are not on nintedanib or pirfenidone. At the same time, we've also seen that there is another cadre of patients that emanate from the Galapagos trials that were recently concluded. So, and also on top of that, there is the COVID-19 dynamic, which is happening in different parts of the world. We see the vaccination now making a good impact in the UK, for example. So I think it's too early to say that we'll have a specific difficulty to include patients. We do think that the simplified trial that we now offering with a 2-to-1 randomization is a good opportunity for many patients around the world.
Toby, I think the next question would be best addressed by you, and that's, can you elaborate on what you're seeing in the patient population with an IPF and how it differs before in terms of severity of disease with patients that are coming in these days?
I guess we're alluding there to the impact of COVID on clinical practice. It's been an interesting time because there has been a definite drop in new patients presenting with respiratory disease in the last 12 months. So we haven't seen the number of newly diagnosed cases that we would normally have expected to. And certainly in the last few weeks, I've started to see new cases of IPF where patients have clearly left it a very long time before seeking medical assistance. So I think, as well as all the cases that we would expect to have diagnosed in 2021, we will be seeing some cases who should have been diagnosed last year but have now sat on their disease and their symptoms for 6 to 9 months, who are going to be more severe than we would otherwise have expected them to be. So I think, just thinking from a clinical trial point of view, we are likely to see a huge surge in patient numbers just as we recover from COVID and healthcare systems try and get back to normal. And I think there'll be a mix of the usual patients we would have seen and patients who are more severe, have worse symptoms and more advanced physiology as a consequence of delaying seeking healthcare advice.
Toby, a follow-up to that was, can you comment on the split between treatment-naive patients and those that are currently on or have been exposed to current standard of care with patients that you see?
The challenge is the difference between the practice of expert centers and the practice of non-expert centers. So if you look at across the US, various studies estimate that somewhere between 50 to 60% of patients with a diagnosis of IPF just haven't been offered treatment for whatever reason, either because of therapeutic nihilism on the part of their local physician or even a lack of knowledge about the role of antifibrotic drugs. But if you come to a center like mine, you're going to find that all patients will have been offered treatment, and probably about 80% of patients at any one time will be on therapy. A small number will be treatment naive because they will have chosen not to initiate treatment, and the majority not on treatment will have struggled with side effects with both drugs. If we just go back to my UK practice, because of the reimbursement, it was about 40 to 50% of patients weren't on drug, and about 40 to 50% were on drug. And the majority of patients who weren't on drug, that was because of reimbursement.
Great, thanks, Toby. The last question that I've got, Hans, maybe you might want to address, when can folks expect top-line results from the COVID-19 study that Galecto participated in?
Yes, thank you. Good question. Data analysis is currently ongoing. We are expecting to be able to provide an update and the full data from that trial in Q2. That's unfortunately as specific as I can be at this time. We hope in the, certainly in the sooner rather than later, and we look very much forward to sharing the data from that trial with you.
And that's it from a Q&A perspective on the inbound questions. So with that, Hans, maybe turn it back to you for some closing remarks.
Sure. Thanks, John, and thanks, panel. Thank you also to the participant for excellent and insightful questions. It's been a pleasure answering them. And of course, a special thanks to Toby for taking part, providing the review of the current field in IPF and especially of GB139. It was our intent to inform you on the prospects of GB139 in this session, and we hope we've been able to satisfy your curiosity and explain why we are very excited and confident in the potential of GB139. So thank you, everybody. I'll just show on this slide that apart from GB139, we do have two other compounds in clinical testing, GB2064, a LOXL2 inhibitor for myelofibrosis, and GB1211, which is also targeting galectin-3, but is orally active. And we plan to start a trial in non-small cell lung cancer in the second half of this year, and a trial in liver cirrhosis around the summertime. So look forward to updates from Galecto and a very data-rich year in next year. So thank you, everybody. And with that, I'll hand back to Tara.
Thank you, Hans. This concludes today's webinar. You may now disconnect.